Hey, everybody, from the tech desk here in Brussels, Belgium, it's Clark, and it's time for Tech Podcast number 320. The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH Public Radio in Boston. You can find out more about the show, including all of our other great podcasts, at theworld.org. All right, this is the second podcast I've produced today. I wanted to leave you with two of them because I'm on vacation next week. All right. A little bit earlier, I gave you a slightly different kind of podcast. It wasn't strictly speaking about technology, but this one's got a lot of really good tech stories in it. So hopefully, if you were upset by the last one, this one will make up for it. Of course, we continue to follow events out of the Middle East and North Africa. As I've said before, we keep looking for interesting technology angles. One very short update that I'd like to give you concerns another group that is working very hard to make sure that video material collected by people inside Libya can get out. So here's our host, Marco Werman, with that update.
The uprising against Muammar Gaddafi may already be the bloodiest of all the uprisings in the Middle East. It's hard to know, given that reporters have not been able to report much of the violence firsthand. Many Libyans have defied restrictions to post reports and video on the internet. One web-based organization called One Day on Earth has developed a number of contacts inside Libya. Some of those contacts have been uploading video images of the unrest. Executive producer Brandon Littman says many of the videos are shaky and hard to understand, but one clip is clear and chilling. The video shows a beachside cemetery looking out over the Mediterranean Sea. The beach is filled with people preparing dozens of graves, presumably for protesters killed in the violence. Littman says the people on the beach seem almost detached from the tragedy.
The footage itself, though, is scary. I mean, you're seeing people bury their loved ones in a way that is almost as if they're traumatized and disconnected from that moment. You know, they're going through probably one of the most horrific political situations I could ever think of. And they're faced now with collecting the bodies of their loved ones. And from what we heard from our source, there were plenty of bodies still in the streets because people could not go and collect them safely because they feared being gunned down while doing that.
For security reasons, Littman won't describe the exact methods used to upload the images, but he says One Day on Earth has verified the video's geographic location in Tripoli, and he says One Day on Earth's mission is to continue to make unedited footage from Libya available to the outside world.
Our primary goal right now is just to keep our community and keep the people that are listening informed of what's going on in an unfiltered way, in a way that is raw and from the people experiencing it.
You can see the video from Tripoli that Brandon Littman was describing, and I should warn you, it's hard to watch. We've posted a link at theworld.org.
Of course, we're also staying on the WikiLeaks story. Julian Assange is still fighting extradition from the UK to Sweden. But one thing that is interesting in the WikiLeaks story, I think, and that is not a lot has been said about Bradley Manning, who is the U.S. soldier accused of leaking those tens of thousands of documents. And more to the WikiLeaks website. It turns out that the U.S. military filed 22 new charges against Manning this week. One of them was aiding the enemy, which is a capital offense. Now, Manning's case, like the whole WikiLeaks phenomenon, seems to have split American public opinion. For some, Manning is a pariah. For others, he's a hero. Now, the BBC interviewed Ray McGovern, who is a retired CIA officer but is now an outspoken political activist on intelligence and war issues. The BBC started by asking Ray McGovern for his views on the charges now facing Bradley Manning.
The administration and the Army have been furiously seeking some kind of law under which to charge Bradley Manning of something really heinous. And so they found this law, found out that they needed to charge him with aiding the enemy to make it work. And so abracadabra.
They're surely not looking for the death penalty, though, are they?
They're looking to appear very tough. And the supreme embarrassment, of course, is the material, the substance of what he divulged. And those were things that were not endangering our national security. On the contrary, they were endangering only the tenure and the reputation of people like George Bush, Dick Cheney, and I'm sad to say, our current president and vice president.
You've taken up the cudgels on behalf of Bradley Manning. You made a one-man protest in front of Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. basically, it appears from what I've read that you were duffed up, to put it bluntly. What happened?
Well, I had a ticket to listen to Hillary Clinton give her address at George Washington University. And when she came in and I looked at her and I saw the rather fulsome applause she was getting, as though everyone agreed with the policies that she has waged or been responsible for in Iraq and Afghanistan, her menacing attitude toward Iran, I decided that I could not sit there quietly and make believe that I was acquiescent in that kind of applause. And so I stood, and when everyone else sat down, I turned my back to her and remained motionless, silent, just facing the back of the auditorium. Everything was going swimmingly for about the first two minutes, 10 seconds, they tell me, by the videotape, when two men surprised me, blindsided me, grabbed me, and brutalized me through the aisle, through two pair of steel handcuffs on my wrists, and put me in the back of a patrol car. I was taken to the local D.C. jail and kept there for 3.5 hours before released. I was charged with disorderly conduct, mind you. In any case, this morning, when I went to my arraignment, the government indicated that it would not press any charges, that, as it put it, there is no paperwork that would justify prosecuting me.
And Ray, so, do you mind me asking you how old you are?
I'm 71. There has been a callous disregard for our Bill of Rights, the first 10 amendments to our Constitution, which establish and guarantee these freedoms. And I'm glad, in a sense, that I was brutalized. My wounds are healing. But we have won a very important case by their failure to prosecute, and by the indication thereby that the First Amendment lives, that people can exercise peaceful means of protest, even in the face of such a dignitary as Mrs. Clinton.
And what was the subject, briefly, of Hillary Clinton's address?
It was like something out of Franz Kafka. The subject was freedom, internet freedom, treating dissidents respectfully. At one point, three paragraphs after I was dragged out in full view, she was ranting and railing against the Iranians. You know what the Iranians do? They persecute dissidents. They follow them, they arrest them, and they beat them up.
Okay, let's shift gears here a little bit. If you've ever sat through school exams, you may remember your hands aching from writing essays nonstop for several hours. Well, of course, now so many of us use computers most of the time, you've almost completely lost that ability to write. We wonder how we would cope if we had to sit through exams like that now. Well, this was an interesting interview that the BBC did with Isabel Nisbet. She's the outgoing head of the regulating body for exams and qualifications in England. She's actually leaving to go to Singapore. And it's interesting, as a parting shot in this interview, she says it might be time to give up on pen and paper and exams. And the BBC started by asking her about the current scope of computer use in exam halls across the world.
In most countries which have a lot of use of technology and learning, there is some use of computers in some tests that young people take. In Scandinavia, they've been making some more experiments with this. But in all countries, including where I'm going in the Asia-Pacific region, there's a big question being asked by education is how do we make sure that the tests match how the children learn? And in particular, in some of the countries, including Singapore, where some of the mother tongues have calligraphy involved in writing, there's a worry that they might lose the skill of actually writing the characters, because on screen you're matching characters rather than writing them. But there's a similar issue in Britain about whether we're losing the art of writing. But on the other hand, that if people are having to learn to write just to sit their exams, then maybe it's not the right kind of exam.
I would say there's a lot of people listening to you saying, yeah, I really don't write in the way that I used to. If I was asked to sit down and write for 2 hours solidly, I would firstly get cramp in my hand, and secondly, by the end of it, it'd be pretty hard to read.
Yes.
Because we use computers all the time.
Yes.
We don't use quills carefully prepared with penknives anymore. Perhaps we don't need to use any kind of paper anymore except that comes out of a computer printer.
I think we need to realise that the best testing should match the best learning, and it shouldn't be lagging behind. And it's about time we took this off the too difficult pile and started thinking about it, because there's a long lead time to change exams, to make sure that they're fair and secure. You've got to do a lot of planning, so you've got to start thinking about it now.
It would be, of course, a security question. There'd be interest in how you could avoid plagiarism and so on if people were using computers. That's what's put it on the difficult pile, I suppose.
Well, yes. First of all, on security, there are security issues with all kinds of exams. At the moment, we have a great industry with parcels and vans and barcoding and making sure that they're locked in secure cupboards with double locks and that they're not open and all this stuff. And every year we have a hijacked van or a parcel that goes missing or something that goes on fire. And that's just, you know, something you have to tackle. There are security issues around computers. There are ways of dealing with them, for example, by different candidates doing different questions at different times, and actually by having visual shields that make sure that they can't look over other people's shoulders. And there are ways of tackling those. There's also issues about students who have special needs or disabilities, but the same is true with pen and paper for people, for example, that have difficulty in writing or have a hand injury. There's also big practical issues about making sure that the computers are in the schools and that they work and that they're at the same speed. And I'm not decrying any of those. I'm just saying let's start thinking and let's start planning, because I'm not even thinking about the teenagers now. I'm looking at the 10 and 11-year-olds. And for people with children of that age, look at the way that they learn, the way that they just instinctively use technology to widen their inquiries, and we need to match them.
The price of computers is coming down, and I suppose while it's going to cost a lot more than a ballpoint pen, you can see how computers that get plenty of use by children might eventually add up economically. What about at home, though? Not everyone can afford a computer. All right, the great majority have something with which they connect to the internet, but there's still a large proportion that don't.
Yes, and there's equality issues. I should say that in the previous generations, there were equality issues as well for people whose parents were rich enough to afford to buy encyclopedias and things like that. In fact, the proportion of children in England who have access in some way to the web is now really pretty high. And there are issues about making sure that there's technology for children to use to learn in schools. And those are very important issues. All I'm saying is that the way that they're tested should not suddenly jump back a century. We have to think how to support the really fine education that many of our young children are getting.
How long do you think it'll be before taking exams on computers will be commonplace?
I can't give a year, but we have to be less risk-averse from my generation, because instinctively we think, well, that's not the kind of exam I used to sit. What happens if they lose the, or if it goes off, or it the plug comes out or it gets lost? But the fact is that parcels get lost and pens get lost and vans get lost. So we just have to realise, and I think that is the world we're in, and I actually think that young children are better at that than my generation is.
Is it time for pen and paper to go? Well, you can always leave your thoughts on the Facebook page. That's facebook.com/worldstechpod. You can talk to us on Twitter. We're also Worlds Tech Pod on Twitter, or stop by theworld.org/technology and leave a comment. All right. There's a big technology hoo-ha going on in Germany this week. It's called CeBIT. And friend of the podcast, Cyrus Farivar, who is the host of Deutsche Welle's Spectrum podcast, highly recommended. You should check it out. It's a weekly like us and covers some really cool and interesting tech stories. Cyrus is the host of it. He happened to go along to CeBIT and was kind enough to donate to the tech podcast this little piece that he had done on some of the interesting stuff that he saw at CeBIT. Here we go.
If there's one piece of technology that I thought would never change, it's the cocktail shaker. After all, what could be simpler than a metal cup designed to shake and chill alcohol? But wouldn't you know it, German government scientists have now designed a cocktail shaker that talks to you.
Hallo, kommen Sie doch etwas näher.
Who am I to disregard the instructions of an anthropomorphic cocktail shaker that is teaching me how to make a white Russian?
Nehmen Sie zuerst etwas Wodka.
Yes, vodka first. Thanks, shaker, but I already know how to make a white Russian. As I watch this demo, one of the researchers behind this project says he's not trying to teach Germans how to make better cocktails, but rather is exploring how to get everyday objects to interact with each other. Michael Schmidt is an intelligent user interface researcher with the German Research Center for Artificial Intelligence in Saarbrücken.
The point of this is that that in future we're able to equip everyday objects that we use in our daily lives already with electronics, with miniaturized electronics that are able to let these objects talk to each other and communicate with each other, so that they can offer new services beyond the traditional purpose of the traditional object.
In other words, Schmitz explains, the shaker and the bottles of alcohol are equipped with motion sensors and radio frequency identification tags. That means the shaker and the bottles know when they're being picked up, and the shaker knows when the vodka gets close to it and is being poured. As Schmitz makes his cocktail, the shaker continues, complimenting him on his shaking technique.
Yeah, super. Good.
Schmitz says that it may be years before electronics like these become standard in cocktail shakers and bottles of liquor. But he points out that it may not be so far off before your toaster speaks to you to tell you that your toast is ready. Beyond talking appliances, one of the show's biggest attention getters has been Turkey, the convention's partner country this year. Turkey's Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan was on hand with his counterpart Angela Merkel for the opening ceremony on Monday evening. There are all kinds of Turkish companies here, ranging from big ones like Turkcell and Turksat to a small Turkish startup called Yogurt and its online community, Yogurtistan. After watching a demo for a few moments, Yogurtistan strikes me as a bit like the virtual online 3D community Second Life. There are avatars, living environments, and even a virtual currency, explains Guldeniz Akpolat, one of Yogurt's founders. But she says there's a key difference.
For this kind of things, you need plugins.
You need to download something,
but here on Facebook you can reach them, and it's also a social network. You can use Yogurtistan as a social network. It's not only a game.
In other words, Yogurtistan runs as an application on Facebook. It seems very similar to other social networking games, like the ever-popular Mafia Wars and Farmville. Those games can be played for free, but have virtual currency that people can buy with real money as a way to get virtual items in the game. As of now, Farmville's parent company, Zynga, has an estimated value of billions of dollars. In other words, online Facebook gaming and virtual communities is big business. For now, Akpolat says that the Facebook application is still in invite-only beta mode and has around 1,000 users, mostly in Turkey. So it might be a while before Yogurtistan takes off. But if there's one thing that clearly is taking off at this year's CeBIT, it's research into robotics. There are already a handful of robots on hand that are making waves. One of the most recognizable is one called Robothespian, the acting robot.
Play Hamlet.
Or not to be.
Robothespian made the cover of CeBIT's magazine this year. It's being developed by a British company called Engineering Arts as an experiment in voice recognition and interface design. Will Jackson, the company's director, explains.
How do you spend most of your life communicating? You spend your life talking to other people. Talking to a laptop is kind of uncomfortable and weird. Talking to something that looks more like a person and behaves like a person feels much more natural. So this is the idea behind a humanoid communication robot.
But the thing is, although Robothespian is billed as the acting robot, this machine can do much more than just recite Shakespeare. Jackson says that his company has tried to combine the memory and retrieval storage capacity of an artificial intelligence in the vein of the recent Jeopardy-playing computer, Watson, with their robot's interface.
One example we've done is a kind of wiki robot. So you say, robot, tell me about dolphins. Basically, he pulls up everything he can find on dolphins. Now, we all know what information on the net is like. It's not guaranteed to be true, but he'll qualify that and say, I'm getting this from Wikipedia.
Again, like many of the prototype products here at CeBIT, this robot doesn't come cheap. Right now, if you want to bring him home, you're going to have to plunk down 65,000 euros, or about $90,000. And no matter how you slice it, that's a lot of virtual items, or cocktails.
So again, that's Cyrus Farivar, host of Deutsche Welle's Spectrum podcast. Be sure to check it out. I'll put a link up at theworld.org/technology as well. Here's how we're going to end Tech Podcast 320. We got some language teaching robots in South Korea. Here we go.
In South Korea, grade schoolers return to class this week after a two-month winter break. Most students there study English. They're usually taught by native speakers flown in from around the globe. But at one school, students have been studying with the help of a teacher that didn't come from abroad. In fact, she was completely assembled in Korea. Reporter Jason Strother has a story from Daegu.
Meet Inki. She's the Hakjung Primary School's newest English teacher. She's about 3 feet tall and kind of shaped like a penguin. She's a robot.
How are you, William? What you do?
Inki wheels around the front of the classroom and stops in front of each of the 6 fourth graders taking part in this educational pilot program. She asks them to repeat English phrases and leads them in song. But Inki is not entirely a robot. She's hooked up via teleconference to the Philippines, where an English teacher conducts the class through a video monitor. It's a kind of outsourcing. When Inki speaks, students hear the instructor's voice, and they see a Caucasian face that appears on Inki's retractable LCD panel head. But Inki's creators say this robot is much more than just a video screen on wheels. Kim Moon-sang is director of the Intelligent Robotics Program at the publicly funded Korea Institute for Science and Technology in Seoul. He says Inki is most like an avatar.
We have some perception technology. We can detect the motion of the English teacher. As soon as the teacher moves his hand, the robot raises his hand. If the teacher, for example, laughs, then we can detect his laughing expression. So the robot can do just like the English teacher do.
Kim says Inki also has an autonomous mode.
Repeat after me. Book.
The robot is programmed to help students with their English pronunciation. It plays a little tune when they get a word right.
Let's try this one more time.
Or lets them take another shot at it. Learning English is all about repetition, and that makes a robot an ideal teacher. That's according to Jang Byung-ok, principal at the Hakjung School. And Jang says there's another reason to choose robots over foreign teachers. They're less expensive. He says it costs around $40,000 a year to support a foreign English teacher in Korea. It's about half the price to build an Inki and contract with a Filipina teacher. But some observers say there are better ways for the government to save money and improve education here. Yoo Do-hyun lectures in English education and pedagogy at Seoul's Gukmin University.
We need Korean teachers also. For beginners or for intermediate, the Korean teachers know how to learn English easily. What's the problem for Korean students?
And Yu says English teaching robots would deprive students of the most basic reason for learning a foreign language, human interaction.
Communication is between, you know, humans. So they need practicing with, native speakers, human teachers. Even though they practice English a lot with the robots, when they meet with human native speakers, they still would be very nervous because they haven't conversed with real human native speakers.
Inki creator Kim Moon-sang says he'd like to see all Korean schools use robots one day, but he isn't so sure they could ever totally replace human teachers. He adds, in the end, it's the students who will determine whether robots can be successful substitute teachers.
Whether they can, emotionally accepted by the students.
Let's watch the dish.
At the Hakjung School, Inki receives high marks from the students. One 10-year-old boy, whose English name is Tony, says he was a little nervous about the robot at first, but he liked its singing and dancing. And 10-year-old Charlotte says, I like the robot teacher better than human teachers.
Hi, teacher!
For The World, I'm Jason Strother, Daegu, South Korea.
We have a video of Inki, the robot working in the classroom. You can see it at theworld.org.
Okay, a quick dip into the mailbag here before we end completely. Listener Ben Wolfram from the Pacific Northwest, the U.S. Pacific Northwest, that is, wrote in to alert everyone that if you loved the piece on Jerry Wells, the radio guy Jerry Wells, remember that from a couple episodes ago, he's actually featured in a radio and television series called The Secret Life of Machines. And Ben wanted me to let everyone know that you can check that out at YouTube or at secretlifeofmachines.com. So if you want more of Jerry Wells, that's the place to get it. Now, also wanted to note that Dave Gazzaraga stopped by the Facebook page to say, "Hey, Clark, I'm back on my motorcycle, traveling around the world again, listening to the World's Technology Podcast." You may remember I mentioned Dave before because he was listening to the tech podcast while he was riding his BMW motorcycle through South America, which sounded like it must just have been a lot of fun. But Dave wanted to note that I'm in Thailand now, and I was listening to your show as I was riding through some of the remaining jungles of Cambodia. Most of the jungle is actively being cleared to set up for cash crops like rubber. It was great to hear stories of the developing world while in the developing world. Makes the stories even more real. I had to find out. I want to know what Dave is riding. So I wrote back and I said, "What are you riding, Dave?" And he says, "I'm riding a little Suzuki 400cc dirt bike." He rode around the United States for a few months and then he shipped it to Southeast Asia. He says, "I've been here since November and he's going to ship it to Amsterdam. And then from Europe, he's going to head until the road ends going east." And that is Magadan, Russia, folks. Dave is unstoppable. If you want to follow Dave, because let's face it, the listeners to the Technology Podcast, they do really cool things. You can follow Dave at davegtravels.com. So davegtravels.com. I'll put that link up on the show notes as well, theworld.org/technology. One last note that Dave wanted to pass along. As far as tech goes, the most amazing things are what people do to scooters here. They're heavy transport vehicles in Southeast Asia. The other great thing is that nothing is ever thrown away here. Everything is fixed. There are some true mechanics out in Southeast Asia. Well, Dave, thanks for writing in. Thanks too to Ben for writing in. Please keep the information coming, folks, because if you're interested in it, chances are good that a lot of other listeners out there are interested in it. And I'm happy, more than happy, to pass this kind of stuff along. You can always reach me at Clark, clark.boyd, B-O-Y-D, at bbc.co.uk. I'll be back with you in a couple of weeks. Bye-bye.
Support for the World's Technology Podcast comes from the National Science Foundation, where discoveries begin, nsf.gov, and from the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs and their innovations to solve the world's most pressing problems at skoll.org.